Welcome to KMXT's Talk of the Rock, our local community affairs program, where we explore issues and organizations related to our community. Talk of the Rock is hosted by members of the KMXT News Team.
You're listening to KMXT's Talk of the Rock program, and today I have a special guest, somebody I've always admired, Hobo Jim, who is also Jim Varsos. And those of you who haven't lived in Alaska long may not know the Iditarod song, but it's one of my favorites and always has been since the first time I heard it. And Hobo Jim's always done a lot of Alaska songs, and now he's also doing other things, but we think of Hobo Jim as an Alaska country, folk, that kind of music. And so how are you doing there, Jim? Or should I call
you Hobo? I'm doing wonderful, thanks. Yeah, Hobo's great. Thanks for having me on.
Now, you're in Tennessee.
Right now I'm in Tennessee, yeah. My main home is still in Soldotna, but I've kept a home down this way for probably about 30 years also for the business. So.
And when you say the business, what are you talking about?
Well, outside of my performing, I'm a songwriter, producer. I'm 99% of my career is Alaska music and Alaska shows wherever I play in the world. But in Nashville, I do write commercial country music for name artists. I've written songs for people like George Jones and Etta James and a lot of folks like that. So
that must be exciting. Like way cool.
Yeah, it's a... My roots are still, I mean, I still like going back to my Alaska stuff, but it's fun to be in the commercial trade too. I don't do that quite so much as I used to, but I still do a little bit here.
Now, how long did you grow up in Alaska? How did you get to Alaska?
This is my 49th year in Alaska starting this month. And so I came up to Alaska before the pipeline, and the name Hobo Jim is not a stage name. I could have done better than that if I knew I was on stage, could have been on stage. But I left home young and I hitchhiked around the country and rode freight trains. And it was a nickname given to me. It was my name when I hit Alaska. And hitchhiked up to Alaska as a young kid and started commercial fishing and lumberjacking and cowboy and whatever I could do. And I wrote songs about all that and just kind of took off.
I can see the hobo now. If you were on trains and doing that old, crawling on the train and catching it to the next stop and getting off, that's stuff you see on television, on movies.
Yeah, I actually did that for a long time. And nowadays they called it homeless. I called it free, but it was pretty fun.
So you came to Alaska and you did a lot of fishing. You did a lot of little bit of everything. Were you involved in the pipeline? Did you go work on getting involved in that?
No, you know,
work?
It's funny. It's one of the few. I mean, I've been up to Endicott and Prudhoe and all. I played at all the camps when I was playing music for a living, but I never was involved in the oil industry for working. And during that time period, I was a commercial fisherman. And I have done a lot, but most Alaskans back then did. You just did whatever you could seasonally to survive. So my first 6-7 years in Alaska was a combination of fishing, logging, and singing. I'd sing in the bars every chance I get. And write songs about all my Alaska lifestyle, and eventually people wanted to hear me sing more than they wanted to see me work. And I was always better at singing than working, so we stayed with that.
And so I'm doing some calculating in my head. We're talking 60s, early 70s?
Early 70s, yeah.
Okay.
I think I got to Alaska in January of 72. So.
72. I got here in May of 78.
Yeah, so you came about the same time my wife came. It was just starting to change.
I was in the Coast Guard, so I was a little oblivious to what it was going on. At least that's
Well, thank you for your service. And there's very few states like Alaska where Coast Guard are highly appreciated by commercial fishermen.
Oh, yeah, for sure. We love our coasties, and thank you. So tell me about commercial fishing, and I know you've written several songs about it. And what was it like fishing then? Tell me some of your fish stories.
It was a lot wilder and probably a lot more unregulated. If there were regulations, I don't think many people paid attention to them. But coming out of Homer, Homer and Kodiak were a lot alike. We were a major crab port Kodiak delivered there a lot. Seldovia had a crab fleet. They delivered there a lot. Homer. And it was in the days when boats would come in with, you know, they delivered millions and millions of pounds of giant king crab to the docks and Dungeness crab. And you know, a lot of money flowing. I think we had one cop. I think they hired a second cop when I was young. But the bars were wild and full up of reality fishermen with a lot of money in their pockets and ringing the bell. And, you know, it was just frontier. And salmon fishing was, you know, I think when I started fishing on drifting for salmon, it was pretty good the first year, and then it went really downhill, and about the time I quit, it started getting good again. but one of our boats in Homer, it used to be a friend of mine, Johnny Hillstrand, who had the Sea Witch, and then he built the original Time Bandit, brought it to Homer. And so one of my songs that most of the fishermen know, called Off to Dutch Harbor, is a song that Johnny asked me to write for a christening party that we had on the original Bandit. And he passed away about 15, 20 years ago. And his kids are the ones that are on TV now with that boat, but he never lived to see any of that. But it was wild days back then.
I know some of them because I did a series with the Kodiak Maritime Museum about when crab was king. And so I had the fortune of interviewing a lot of the people involved in the crab fisheries, the originals, before they passed on or before, you know, they still had good memories and could tell those stories. And I remember a lot of those stories. And you used a phrase that people may not know, and that was ringing the bell.
Yeah, ringing the bell. And sometimes, you know, even when I play music in the bars during the crab days, so, you know, I remember full house of, 200 people, and that bell would ring 8, 10, 12 times a night, you know, buying rounds for the house. And it was just insane. And you know, we had king crab in the catch, right in the Ketchmack Bay in the Cook Inlet. Now they're extincted. And I have one of my lines of a song, called The Old Anchor Bar, said, now all that remains is the glory in the stories that we tell. It was a storybook time to live in.
Adventure, for sure. And I just want to clarify so people know, ringing the bell means that if you're in the bar and you ring the bell, that means you're buying rounds for everybody. So if there's 200 people there, you're buying rounds for 200 people. And if somebody else did it, then they're buying rounds for 200 people. You could just be in the bar hanging out, not to pay a penny, because they'd be buying.
And not just that, but we used to have something called six-packing, which the state made illegal, but they used to buy you six drinks at a time. And quite often when a crab fisherman had a really good season, he'd come in and ring the bell and would say six pack everybody in the bar, and he'd buy everyone six drinks. And it was so crazy. People would call from Dutch Harbor to Homer, and they would call all the bars in Homer and ring the bell when they weren't even there and said, I'll pay you when I get in.
Yeah, I'd forgotten about six packing. But yeah, they did that a lot. And they did also that pay after fishing, or they really were very trustworthy with all these fishermen. But they had so much money, and they got it so quickly later, and I guess they paid their bills or they wouldn't have done it.
And 99% of them just, you know, they had their money and they blew it in the bar and went back and got more. But not very many people ended up with a lot to show for it after all of that.
And that made me think of the pipeline. That was a lot of the same thing. I was there. One guy.
And of course, the fishermen and the pipeliners, the old Alaskans and the pipeliners, when they first started coming up, it was great conflict. And it was pretty obvious who was in the bar with the pipeline and who was a fisherman or a local. And there was many, many, many fights. And, you know, the bars were pretty wild places back then.
I have heard that. I was not a bar goer, and I got here a little bit after that. It had really settled down a lot when I first got here. Okay, so let's talk about some of your music specifically. Now, my favorite is, and I don't think it's the right, I don't call it by the right name. What is it called? The Iditarod song, or what is that song?
Yeah,
title?
The Iditarod Trail song. And in 1982, I was asked to write a song for the Iditarod to be the official song of the Iditarod. And I wrote that song. They gave me like a 6-month notice, and I wrote it like a couple hours before I flew to Nome. and played it live on ABC, and town, no one went crazy. All the mushers loved it, and I must have played that song 20 times that night. And it just kind of took off, and it really, the single song there changed my career. It ended up getting me a recording contract with Flying Fish and Rounder Records, and put me out on tour with name bands across the United States doing my Alaska songs. And even to this day, I mean, that song's almost 40 years old, and it's still taught in all the elementary schools, and, you know, several generations of singing that song.
But it's such a catchy tune, too. And I could see where kids would love it. I did the Iditarod Trail. I mean, who could?
Yeah, and I play, you know, some of the cool things in my life. I mean, I play in Japan and I play in Germany, but to watch these kids from other countries sing it, it's just kind of neat to see a Japanese kid singing I did the Iditarod Trail, or a German kid. It's funny.
Well, you know, now they have those really nice websites about the Iditarod, and they have all those student tools to help you, you know, teach math or teach science or, you know, teach different writing and stuff around using the Iditarod as kind of the focus. So I'd imagine that even has still quite a bit of a life with young children.
Yeah, and Shelley Gill, and the writer Shelley Gill and Shannon Cartwright put out that curriculum, the Iditarod curriculum that they use nationwide. And I was part of that with them. I worked on that curriculum with them. And the Iditarod Trail song is one of the songs I actually teach all over the country now. And our teachers on the trail come up from, you know, New Jersey and Kentucky and wherever. And they come up to follow the Iditarod. And they do they use the Iditarod for kids to follow the Iditarod, pick a musher, and they advance on the board by how many books they've read. So.
Right. Yes, I could see that. And Shelley Gill and Shannon Cartwright, they just do amazing stuff with those books of theirs, don't they?
They do. And Shelley and I, when I was hoboing in the old days, I was a street singer in New Orleans. And then I went to work at a little coffee house playing music there. And Shelley was a bartender there. And we became friends down there. And a year or two later, I hitchhiked to Alaska. And a few years later, she'd ended up in Alaska, and we'd never been in contact with each other since the coffee house there. And we both moved to Homer, and we ended up hooking up again. That was kind of funny.
Oh, I bet that would be fun. A lot of people kind of wind in and out of Alaska. I guess we draw each other like magnets to metal, drawing us in. Now, some of these songs that you've listed here, that you gave me this list ahead of time, we talked a little bit about the Time Bandit. And then the Lady Lee, I know that these songs are particularly of interest to fishermen when they can hear, basically you're telling their story. You're telling the story of fishing, and not just telling it, but you lived it. So it's kind of an autobiographical song.
Yeah, most of the songs that I've written are pretty close to what I've done in my life. You know, I mean, being a song, you take some poetic liberties, But the Lady Lee was starts out, we're halfway back to Kodiak when the gale began to blow. And it's a song about a boat going down. And I actually wrote the song pretty much in my sleep. I had a dream, and then I dreamed I was writing the song. And I woke up and it was pretty much done. But it's a song about a ghost boat saving a crew. And I've got some songs. I got a song called the F.B. Marianne that I wrote about a boat going down and the guy dying, crying out his wife's name. But that song was actually written about a compilation of a bunch of my friends that I've lost at sea, and one of them actually being from Kodiak. I won't mention the name, but went down in a boat and froze out in a survival bell. And it's just, you know, it's a rough lifestyle, and there's a lot to write about, you know?
Right. For sure. I mean, I do writing, but I don't. Sometimes I talk to people like you and I think, you know, I maybe should write down some of these little vignettes of life. I've been here 40 some years. When I got here in the 70s, I always think of these things. When I got here in the 70s, 40 years ago, then would have been in the 30s. And that was before World War II. And so,
yeah.
I mean, I don't look back and think, oh, that was a long time ago, 40 years ago. But if I look at and compare it to where I was you know, what was 40 years, that was a big change. I don't know if that makes any difference.
And everybody, I mean, I'm sure you're being in Kodiak, everybody who lived through that era that we did, it was a transitional period from being the frontier to what it is now. And we're all looking at it now that it's pretty civilized, but to most people from outside, it's still not civilized at all. And I was fortunately blessed with a good memory, but I wish I would have written down more stuff. But I'm in the middle of doing an autobiography book, and things that I thought were everyday mundane stuff, now when you put it down in a book, it's amazing to read it myself and think about how crazy it really was for all of us, you know?
Right, right. I mean, even just basic stuff that people who don't live here could understand. Like in the old days, we never wore seatbelts when I was growing up. Can you imagine life without a seatbelt? Just like, what?
Actually, I do. No, I can't do. But you know, and the idea that from Nanilchik down to Homer, we had one cop and a lot of action in the bars, and the police station was closed at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and on weekends, and you know. It's just pretty amazing that we all survived through days like that.
I think you had to be, I don't want to say you had to be tougher back then, but I think you had to have a more of a survivor mentality.
Yeah.
And you just took those things in stride, because so many of the things we did, like you said, we just thought they were normal. They were normal for us. And that was, it's kind of that lifestyle thing. This was our lifestyle. This was our day-to-day life. And it was normal to us. And not that you
did. My boy, who was born in Homer, but he took a wife in Nashville. But when he's out here, he says, you know, his saying is, there's tough and there's Alaska tough, and they're two completely different things. And he's not talking about fighting; he's just talking about attitude in general. You know?
Right, right. And I don't think you come to Alaska unless you've got a bit of adventure, but you certainly don't stay. It's like people, they talk about people in places and they say, well, if you didn't like it, you wouldn't be there. You'd squirrel away your money. You'd get out if this didn't suit you.
Yeah.
And I think that's why we have so many people here who it suits them, because we have chosen to be here. Most of us.
Yeah. And I'd hitchhiked up with two girls and we hitchhiked up the Elkhorn in the wintertime. And back then there was, before the pipeline, there was very, very little traffic. And most of our rides were 10 or 20 miles by a miner or a logger or something. It was a real hard trip getting up there, and I dreaded hiking back down the Alcan, but I only planned on spending 5 or 6 weeks in Alaska and then taking off, and that was, like I said, almost 50 years ago. So
there are a lot of us who have that same story. I was only going to be here for a week, or gosh, I came up for the summer, and doggone it, I'm still here.
And Governor Wally Hickel and I used to joke all the time because we both laid claim to the fact that we got to Alaska with $2.50 in our pocket. They would have been thrilled to see me in that little beanie.
I'm thinking that you're, to me, and I think to a lot of people, you're obviously, I think other people share it, you're like an Alaska treasure. You've been documenting the things that make Alaska cool. And your songs live on so that other people who are maybe never been to Alaska or who has never been outside of Anchorage has a sense of how cool Alaska is. Do you get a feeling that you're like bringing Alaska to the rest of the world, or bringing the history and the culture to other people?
And now I do. You know, when I originally wrote these songs, I had no purpose in writing these songs except for just to sing about what we're doing, you know. I had no dreams of them being recorded or you know, being any. I just wrote the song. There's no intent with them at all. And now when I do my shows, even on Alaska, but definitely when I do my shows overseas and I'm playing this stuff, not only do I feel like I'm unintentionally trying to portray the state of Alaska as it is, but more so now, I think I'm portraying an era, and I feel more like a museum show.
Does that make you an old guy? I feel I'm the museum. Well, folks. Here I am. I'm the museum.
I honestly don't feel a day older than I was when I was 18, and I'm having an actual ball. But when I sing about stuff like this, like you know, songs. My wife and I built a cabin in the woods. We lived without running water and electricity for 7-8 years, me for longer, but my wife and I lived together for 7-8 years without running water or electric and way back in the woods. And you know, now some people do that, but back when I was doing that, about half to three quarters of Homer did that. You know, it wasn't unusual. Now it's like, now I feel like I'm telling stories about, well, back when I was a kid, we walked 10 miles to go to school, you know.
And it was uphill both ways.
Yeah.
All right, let me look at some of these other songs you have on your list here. So Guardian Angel, you said you did this with Janice Ian.
Yeah, Janice Ian is a folk legend, a 10-time Grammy Award nominee, and I think she won 2 Grammys. And lots of people my age know who Janice is. She had a mega hit, not just a U.S. hit, but a worldwide hit during the civil rights era called Society's Child that she wrote when she was like 14 and sang when she was 14 and had a major hit. And then when she was 21, she was the first musical act ever on Saturday Night Live, and she wrote and sang a big hit called At 17. I learned the truth at 17. And Janice and I have been friends for decades, and we were both writers in a very small stall of writers at Warner Brothers, and became real good friends. And we've written songs together that she's recorded. But Janice used to poke me, and every time I do a CD, she said, I want to sing on your CD. And I think, well, what hunting, fishing, killing, trapping song will I do with Janice Ian? And I just couldn't come up with anything. And on my last CD I made, I'd written a song called Guardian Angel, which is a road song. It's a beautiful, lonely road song. And I called up Janice. I said, I think I have the right song. And I played it for her. She said, definitely, yes, I want to sing back up on that. And when she got to the studio, I said, well, here's my idea. I'll sing the first verse. You sing the second verse, and we'll sing the third verse together. And she said, okay, which made a duet out of the song, which is not what I think she intended. But we ended up with this beautiful duet. You know, the only duets I know that she's done together, I think she did one with Aaron Neville. And I know that when she was young, she did one with Leonard Cohen. But I feel real blessed to have had that cut with her. She's an awesome person and really blew me out to be able to do that with her.
Oh, that does sound like a cool adventure. Everything's an adventure with me. I love adventures. I love interviewing people like you who were adventures. You know, your whole life was a big adventure.
You know, and my wife and my buddy, Russell Smith, he just passed away, but he'd played in Kodiak many times. He had a band called the Amazing Rhythm Aces. And Russell's the one that took me out of Alaska and put me on the road. My first tour, we're on a bus with the Aces and going through Colorado with them, and Jimmy Buffett joined part of the tour, and Hunter Thompson joined part of the tour, and it was just, you know, a wild thing. But he used to say, when he did introduce me, he said, Hobo Jim doesn't live life, life lives Hobo Jim. And it's kind of true, just like, no matter where I go, something weird happens all the time.
Now, this next one is from your CD, Wood Smoke, and it's called Fishing for Chickens.
Yeah, I was bored one day in Nashville, and there was a time period I had to write five songs a week. I had to write a song a day, and I wanted to go fishing, and was writing with this other writer, and finally I talked him into writing a fishing song. We wrote that song, and to turn it in, it was just kind of like, it was supposed to be a joke, and I ended up recording it, and then Kenny Peltier from Alaska recorded it, and an Irish singer, Marilyn Seamus Kennedy recorded it, and after that, it went kind of like a cult classic. If you go on YouTube, like hundreds of people recorded that song and made videos of that song and dances out of that song. And there's hardly a folk festival where someone's not playing that. And no one seems to know who wrote it, but it's all over the country, so it's pretty funny.
Now, speaking of recordings and things, let's shift gears just a little bit. You've been in the business a long, long time, back in the old days when cassette players were like, eight-track tapes, right? I mean, those were the big deal.
That was before 8-track, too.
Oh, okay. Well,
my very first record. The only thing I missed was Edisons and 78s. But I see my first record was on 45 RPM, which was the Jukebox Records. And then I was on 33 and a third, the big vinyl, big ones. And then we went to 8-track, and then we went to cassette and CD. And now we're on iTunes and all the download stuff. But, it's amazing. And then my very first record I ever made was in Colorado Sound in Denver. And we were recording a full band on state-of-the-art equipment, which was 8 channels. And now, you know, there's like 120 channels and all this high-tech stuff. But it's pretty amazing.
But, you know, at the same time, though, you as an individual, because the technology has come up, individuals can do their own thing with music and put it online. You don't have to have that big record company behind you.
Absolutely. And I ended up, as I said, I was on Flying Fish Records and I was on Rounder Records. And I was a songwriter for Warner Brothers and MCA. And I worked for Ann Murray for like 7 years. And I ended up buying all my stuff back. I bought my publishing back. I bought all my masters back so that I own everything. And I'm doing my own record company right now, which there's really no need with the age of internet. There's really no need to have a record company. John Prine was the one who started that whole idea with his Oh Boy Records. And he got a little Apple computer when they first came out, bought his stuff back and started selling his records. And you make so little money from a record company on records that, you know, even if you sell 1 million records, you hardly make anything. And so he figured, well, I only have to sell, you know, 10,000 records and I'll make the same as if I'd sell 1 million through a record company. And he started doing it himself. And now a lot of people follow suit. But for anyone out there that's listening and thinking about, you know, the recording, make a business, do it yourself. You can do it.
How long have you been doing it yourself?
You mean just without a record company?
Uh-huh.
So I've been doing it myself now. My past three CDs were by myself. So about 20 years, I think I've been doing it by myself. And it's worked out very, very well. It's the only way to go.
That's good to know. And it's good to know.
And you have full control of everything. And it's just, you know, it's kind of a ego booster to say that, you know, I'm signed with a big record label and all that. But when it all comes down to it, that's all you get out of it. Business-wise, it's not a very good deal.
Was it expensive to buy your records back?
It was very expensive, but it was worth everything.
So let me just remind people that we're talking with Hobo Jim.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I'm really looking forward to these shows. I'm getting ready to start my, this is kind of like the start of my 2020 season in Alaska. And I couldn't think of a better place to start it than Kodiak.
This has been KMXT's Talk of the Rock, our local community affairs program. Tune in next Tuesday at 12:30 to hear more about local issues and organizations.